الحياة.
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय.
ॐ
नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय.
Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 9, Brahma's Prayers for Creative Energy. Text number 9. Yavatatvam separatism. Idam, this. Atmana, of the body. Indriya atta, the sense gratification. Mayabalam, influence of external energy. Bhagavata, of the personality of Godhead. Janaha, a person. Isha, I'm my Lord. Pashyet, sees. Tabhat, so long. Na, not. Samsmriti, the influence of material existence. Aso, that man. Pati sankramita, can overcome. Vyatta api, although without meaning. Dukani vaham, multiple miseries. Vahati, bringing. Kriyata, for fruitive activities. O my Lord, the material miseries are without factual existence for the soul. Yet as long as the conditioned soul sees the body as meant for sense enjoyment, he cannot get out of the entanglement of material miseries, being influenced by your external energy. Translation responsively. O my Lord, the material miseries are without factual existence for the soul. Yet as long as the conditioned soul sees the body as meant for sense enjoyment, he cannot get out of the entanglement of material miseries. Being influenced by your external energy. Purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. The whole trouble of the living entity in material existence is that he has an independent conception of life. He is always dependent on the rules of the Supreme Lord in both the conditioned and liberated states. But by the influence of the external energy, the conditioned soul thinks himself independent of the supremacy of the personality of Godhead. His constitutional position is to dovetail himself with the desire of the supreme will. But as long as he does not do so, he is sure to drag on in the shackles of material bondage. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 2.55, Prajahati idakarvan sarvam pata manogatan. He has to give up all sorts of plans manufactured by mental concoction. The living entity has to dovetail himself with the supreme will that will help him to get out of the entanglement of material existence. Of course, this verse here is expanding on instructions that Krishna gives in the Bhagavad Gita, even in the second chapter, third chapter, that the spirit soul, the bewildered spirit soul, under the influence of the material energy, we think ourselves the doer of activities, but in actuality, the activities are carried out by the material energy. So, as Prabhupada points out, it's the whole trouble of the living entity in material existence is that he has an independent conception of life. You know, that verse, Prabhupada just states it in very plain terms, that we, the living entities, think that they're independent, always act as if they're independent. And he says he is always dependent on the rules of the Supreme Lord in both the conditioned and liberated states. By the influence of the external energy, the conditioned soul thinks that himself independent of the supreme supremacy of the personality of Godhead. So then Krishna describes in the second chapter, when he's giving a summary of the Bhagavad Gita, how one attains the transcendental platform, one who becomes free from the clutches of this false ego, ahankara, is that prajahari yada kaman sarvam patamanogatam. He has to give up all sorts of plans manufactured by mental concoction. In one place in the Bhagavatam, I think it's the first canto, somewhere in those early cantos, Prabhupada says that in his purport, that if you want to give up illicit desires, don't make plans. So, because the non-devotees have a joke that, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. Okay. So, and that, of course, it applies to the... here, Lord Brahma has described in the first verses of this chapter that he has perceived a vision of the personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna. And he's offered his Brahma Samhita prayers, Prabhupada, at some stage, as sort of Prabhupada mentions. And, he has realized Krishna, he has realized Lord Narayan, Vishnu, he has perceived Gavadakshai Vishnu. He understands that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he describes in various statements of Lord Brahma, he does describe his vision of the Absolute Truth as being a person with a personal form. But generally people don't accept the statements of Brahma, even though Lord Brahma. So, if you ask, very common understanding in India especially, who are the three principal deities, Shiva, Brahma, Vishnu, but all throughout Brahma states that the Absolute Truth is a person, but people don't take much notice of Brahma, do they? They try to take some statements from Lord Shiva and which describes the Lord as impersonal, although Lord Shiva doesn't actually state that, but they construe that. Lord Shiva has a Lord Shiva takes charge of those who are unembodied, or those who want to be unembodied, like the impersonalists. He helps them, so there are those who somehow don't have a proper form due to some sinful activity, and there are ghosts and subtle beings and what have you, and he takes them under his shelter and gradually helps them to come to the position where they can take a proper form and perform activities and gradually become elevated. But he also takes the impersonalists under his wing as well, because they're also, in one sense, wanting to be without form. You know. Because he guides those, even those impersonalists, because his mission is to guide them back to the personality of Godhead, but people don't see it like that. They just see he has many impersonalist followers, and therefore, you know, the followers of Lord Shiva are impersonalists, and, you know, it's very easy to construe his statements also as impersonalism. They misunderstand his intentions, you know. It's described that, you know, if Lord Nityananda is seen in a place where they're distributing intoxication and alcohol, you know, one should not assume that he's a drunkard. You know, because Lord Nityananda may go to such places where the most fallen people are, you know, there. Lord Nityananda may associate or give his association, rather, with very fallen people, but one should not assume that because Lord Nityananda is giving his association to Jagai and Madai, that therefore he somehow, you know, likes to associate with people who are very sinful. And similarly, one should not think that because Lord Shiva keeps the association of personalists and ghosts and spirits, that therefore he has that sort of tendency himself, which actually Daksha accused him of. Daksha actually, you know, thought of him in that way, accused him very strongly of associating. So he misunderstood, you know, his whole intention. Although, you know, people accept as common knowledge Brahma, Vishnu and Shiva, really, the most conclusive statements about the Supreme Personality of Godhead, where it's perhaps not as confusing as for the followers of Lord Shiva, you know, the most conclusive statements will come from Lord Brahma in his Brahma Samhita, Srimad Bhagavatam, Brahma Madhavata Sampradaya. But people don't pay a lot of attention, you know, do they? They don't. Not a lot of people worship Brahma. You know, those who worship demigods will generally worship Shiva, you know, Ganesh, sun god, Durga, Kali, like that. You don't find, you know, a lot. I mean, out of hundreds and hundreds that I've, you know, met over decades, I don't think I've ever met one who said, "Oh, I worship Brahma." Has anyone ever met someone? What's that? There's a temple. There is a temple. In Sri Rangoon. Yeah. There's a Brahma temple. There's a story about that. Do you know that story about why Brahma is not worshipped so much? Do you know that story? Brahma. Yeah. Can you tell us that story? Do you know? Oh, okay. I don't know if we want it, but not bad if I might. Okay, so you're not sure if it's bona fide?
Yeah, I don't know.
Does anyone know a bona fide story? we'll leave that. But does anyone know? I've heard a story. I didn't know there was some contention about it. Yeah, it's probably why I've never bothered with it. His statements are very, you know, you read the Brahma Samhita Govinda Mani Purusham Srimad Bhagavatam is just filled with pastimes. Krishna book, the Puranas, but you know, people just don't pay any attention to it at all. So here in this verse, in this section, you find that a personality like Brahma, he's made a statement. I've seen, you know, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He has his transcendental form. And then many of these other verses in his prayer, he's saying, "You don't believe me, do you?" So he's sort of speaking, you know, to convince people, you know, and then of course in these verses, it's, you know, verses 7, 8, and especially 10, Vishwanatha Chakravarti, the core, describes it, you know, generally people who don't accept the statements of Brahma as the Lord as being personal can be fitted into the categories of those who are sinful. They won't accept. Those who are, you know, bewildered by the happiness and distress of the body, you know, hunger and thirst, cold, heat, you know, so they're just always absorbed in that, even though they may be pious people. So, you know, they're not necessarily sinful, but because they're absorbed in the bodily concept of life, they also can't accommodate, or they're not even inclined to accept Brahma's statements. And the jnanis, or those who are, you know, trying to come to a spiritual platform, but you know, the jnanis, of course, the karmis, you know, those who are sinful, those in the bodily concept of life, and even the jnanis, they have one thing in common: is that generally, they're all like to speculate on, you know, what is the nature of the absolute truth, and what is the difference between matter and spirit, which is a very dangerous thing because, you know, people feel that they have some shelter of great spiritual power, but in actuality they have none. They're basically under the laws of material nature like everyone else, so it's a false sense of security. But also, you know, I was hearing yesterday that in the Manusamhita, I think Bhakti Vijaya Purna Maharaj explains that, you know, if someone commit some activity which is not proper. It might be sinful or it may be incorrect. You know, there's some reaction to that. But if someone creates a philosophy to support that, the reaction to that is far, far greater. Yeah. Because then they're literally sweeping up a whole lot of other people into that same illusion. So they're literally, especially if they're canvassing that philosophy. So, you know, that's even worse. You know, if you create a philosophy to substantiate something which is really not factual and which leaves the living entities, human beings, under a false shelter and therefore being, you know, cut down by the material energy in so many ways. And, you know, if one you know, tries to propagate that philosophy, it's very, very dangerous, very dangerous. You know, there's, I mean, there are many examples of that, of course, but, you know, one that comes to mind because it's quite topical at the moment is the Falun Gong. Do you know that in China? You heard of that? Anyone heard of that movement? Anyone heard? Yeah. Do you know what they actually believe in? Mm. Sometimes hard to tell.
Good values.
Good values. Yeah.
Compassion and tolerance.
Yeah. Yeah. So promoting good values and brotherhood and mix it with exercise.
Yeah.
Live a wholesome life, and
yeah,
if you do that, basically, the material energy will leave you alone, right? Yeah. Yeah. It's not working. I'll tell you why it's not working. Because, you know, around the world at the moment, there's a growing alarm amongst people United Nations, Amnesty International, and because what they did in China, of course, was they outlawed that movement. It didn't fit in with any of their political plans. Somehow or another, it was, you know, somehow or another, some of these movements, you know, the government sees it's not working for us, you know, it's perhaps making people a little bit independent in their thinking or something, and it's sort of out of, taking people out of our control, and, you know, to some degree or another. So anyway, they rounded them, they're still rounding them up, thousands of them. So they have the thousands and thousands of these political prisoners, prisoners of conscience, as they may call them, and what they're doing, so what they have been doing for some years, which is now coming out because various those who kept them in the prisons, various doctors who performed various operations on them, and all sorts of others who were so shocked by the ghastliness of what was happening that they've defected from China, left China, and now reporting on what's been going on. And what they've been doing is they've been harvesting bodily parts from that movement. So, you know, because, and the worst part is they're doing it while they're alive, because a fresh body part is worth more. Okay? So if you can get a fresh heart. So literally, a bit tough before breakfast, but literally, you know, if you can take a heart out of a person while they're still conscious and alive, so what they immobilise them with, so they're not unconscious, but they immobilise them, and they take their heart out and things like that, and then they die in pain. But because those bodily parts, when they're fresh like that, you get an extra, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, you know, $40,000, $50,000, you know, hearts, eyelids, you know, kidneys like that. And they've actually been harvesting bodily parts from this Falun Gong movement. Like that. Terrible, isn't it? You know? So there's a big, you know, amongst various nations of the world, you know, there's a big backlash. But of course, most countries know that they have very little, if any, influence in the affairs of China, unless there's some, you know, unless there's some economic sanctions and somehow or another. But actually, China's so economically developed. I think they're one of the most economically developed countries in the world, and they're growing at a rate that's unbelievable. So I don't think they really care. But you know, but it's a point that shows that you know, the material energy is not playing around. You know, the material energy is not playing around, and if we develop some mental concoction of how we, you know, we've got this whole philosophy going, we've made it up ourselves. It seems, you know, it's just not going to stop the material energy. In fact, it's very surprising to, you know, think that, you know, we can just invent something, you know, in our intelligence or, you know, within our minds, and that somehow that's going to, you know, literally hold back all the powerful influences of the universe. It's quite a strange concept, isn't it, when you think about it? You know, we're you know, our planet itself is like a tiny little speck of dust in this vast universe with so many immense powers, and we're just a tiny little creature on this little speck of dust within the whole material energy. You know, there's millions and millions of universes, and somehow we sit and we think, I've got this, you know, thing going on in my head, and that's just going to stop all the powers of the universe. But, you know, an easy way to test that out would be, you know, okay, I've got this thing in my head, I'll just step in front of this train and just test it out, because the universe is a lot bigger You know, if I can try it out in front of a locomotive and that works, maybe I'll try on something bigger. But, you know, people become convinced. You know, so it's a real, you know, that you can see the how determined the living entity is to be independent, and if it's, you know, that even to just literally invent something, but the actual facts of life is, under no circumstances will I accept that. That I am a tiny living entity, you know, completely controlled in every respect by the material energy. So that concept we you know, will not let go of. We would rather invent something ridiculous and then just go happy about our lives. Oh, nothing will happen to me. Like this whole, you know, thing in my head. And, every now and then when something goes wrong, let's make a few alterations, adjust it a little bit. But it's a very dangerous, you know, it's a very dangerous preoccupation with the living entity at that. And of course, that's why, you know, we're hearing here, I mean, we might have thought, oh, gee, we studied that in the Bhagavad Gita, that's real ABCs. You know, here we're up to the third canto, the Srimad Bhagavatam, and I'm hearing the same thing again, you know, about this false ego. It's like, that's old hat. But no, don't ever, you know, we should never take this, you know, we should prepare it, be prepared to hear it again and again until the false ego is gone, actually. Until the false ego, we don't have that sense of independence, we should hear it repeatedly and meditate on it repeatedly. Because there's no use going through a whole day under the false ego. It's better to fix the mind in that from the very beginning, every day, and go through that day, you know, actually under the shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, here, you know, Lord Brahma's just saying straight out, but he knows that even he, you know, his statements will just be dismissed like that. So you can see how difficult it is preaching in Kali Yuga. Very, very difficult to preach Krishna consciousness in Kali Yuga. That, you know, who are we? You know, we're trying to teach people some principles how, you know, Krishna's in control, he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And the rejecting personalities like, you know, Lord Brahma. A very, very difficult task. And, you know, the interesting thing I find about this verse, of course, is that Prabhupada says, talking about the living entity, he is always dependent on the rules of the Supreme Lord in both the conditioned and liberated states. But by the influence of the external energy, the conditioned soul thinks himself independent of the supremacy of the personality of Godhead. So, of course, in Bhakti Vaibhava, we're studying about Jad Bharat, who was a very elevated devotee on the platform of Bhava Bhakti. And, you know, his father, Lord Rishabdev, had given him various instructions on, because Lord Rishabdev eventually left this world and retired and went off, you know, to show us how to attain spiritual liberation and go back to Godhead, although, of course, he was a, you know, the Lord himself. But he taught his sons, and Bharat Maharaj was performing devotional activities and, you know, various meditative processes, which were suitable for that age, of course, in the Pulaha Ashram, which is where the Kali Gandaki River is, and the Shalagrams come from in that part of the India. And a deer came out, and he began to neglect his practices in order to look at what happened. With the deer came out, a lion roared. The mother deer was so frightened that she gave birth to the baby deer and then run off, and I think the mother was killed by the lion, and then Barrett looked after that little deer. So he began to neglect all his spiritual practices completely. He was practically doing nothing of what he was supposed to be doing. And there are... We do understand that the Supreme Lord takes these great devotees and sort of has his hand in these pastimes in order that we learn every lesson that we need to learn. But from face value, we understand that even when one becomes very elevated as a Vaishnava, even then, if we we're not independent, you never get to the point where you're independent of Krishna. One is always dependent upon Krishna, because after all, literally, he is manifesting our existence by his energy. So we are always, even in the liberated state, we have been literally our whole existence, and everything that we do in the spiritual world and the material world is a manifestation of what he allows us to do, what he has manifested for. We're always dependent upon him. But he neglected those spiritual practices and took up other activities and then took birth as a deer as a result. Now, Srila Prabhupada points out in the purport that, this is proof that, even someone who's in a very spiritually well-situated place or platform, if we stray away from the actual path that the Lord wants us to be practicing, there will be ramifications like that. Not that we may think that, I've done so much for Krishna, I've done so much devotional service that, it's okay if I sort of just do something a bit independent from what I think, what Krishna wants me to do, what the spiritual master wants me to do, because, I've earned the right to, and I'm quite spiritually advanced, so, I should, if any problems come up, I should be able to deal with that, like that. We should never think like that. Very, very, very dangerous. Yeah. So that platform is there. And, for us, therefore, Srila Prabhupada has given many, many instructions and, revealed his mission, the activities that we should perform as far as our sadhana, as far as preaching, as far as spreading Krishna consciousness, helping conditioned souls, as far as developing the Vaishnava qualities, as far as fixing our minds on the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, particularly that form. Srila Prabhupada has given us instructions on everything. And in ISKCON, we have that. We are always properly situated, or a devotee is properly protected from the material energy when they, practice spiritual life in such a way that they really want to understand what Prabhupada would have them do in this situation. That's the proper mood of a devotee. Every ISKCON devotee. it doesn't matter who the initiating guru is, the current acharyas are always trying to help us to understand Srila Prabhupada's instructions and mood and be properly situated at his lotus feet. So with the Diksha Gurus, the Shiksha Gurus, they're all helping us to do that. And they know that by being situated nicely at Srila Prabhupada's lotus feet, under his guidance, then both the movement and the individuals will be protected from the influence of Maya. So, you know, we talked before about, even with the, you know, Falun Gong, and, you know, materialists, that they may invent something in their mind, as Prabhupada says, in their fertile brain, and, you know, assume that that's okay because it sounds reasonable to me. But as devotees, we never practice that. You know, we understand the material energy is not going to, you know, just oh, you know, it sounds like a new way of doing things. You know, I like what, you know, Ganga's invented his own way of being a devotee. I think I'll see what happens. She's not going to do that. You know, material energy, she's going to do what she's done since time immemorial. She's going to smash that devotee, you know, to show that, you know, there's that independent mood she will not tolerate. She will not tolerate, especially if we start propagating some nonsense to others. That she won't tolerate that. Very, very dangerous. So, you know, that's the normal day of a devotee. I was talking to a devotee the other day, and you know, someone asked the devotee, someone said that, Prabhupada said, you know, the chilies are in the mode of passion. You know, some devotee was cooking them. And the devotee thought, yeah, it sounds like a really, you know, sort of, you know, just a very narrow, you know, Prabhupada must have had a lot of, you know, said a lot of things about chilies. He said things about everything. So he spent a lot of the day just researching, you know, how many chilies Prabhupada liked to put in a sabji, you know, what did he, you know, were they recommended for medicinal purposes and what have you. And of course, you know, there is a wealth of knowledge, even on chilies, you know. And, you know, he went back to the devotee, said that is a complete misrepresentation of what Prabhupada, you know, his mood on chilies, you know, to just say, you know, oh, there's a devotee, or he likes to have a chili with his prasad. Obviously, in the mode of passion, you know, a devotee, you know, the natural course of a devotee is that everything they do, they, you know, really try to understand that there's an ISKCON way of doing it or a Prabhupada way of doing it. I know when I was as a young devotee, I mean, I'm not a Prabhupada initiated disciple, although, you know, Prabhupada followed, of course. But I know that we were sort of more Prabhupada conscious than Krishna conscious. You know, that was really the mood, you know, we that was very strong in those days. You know, Krishna consciousness was, we would like to attain Krishna consciousness, but we always felt safer being Prabhupada conscious than Krishna conscious in one sense, you know. We really tried to do things Prabhupada's way. We really tried to, you know, research that, you know, someone says something because, especially today in ISKCON, you know, there is a lot of, oh, Prabhupada says it. Prabhupada is quite a lot, but, I know I find, and many other devotees who do a lot of research, that a lot of the Prabhupada says is, you know, really out there. They're, you know, Prabhupada did it's a complete misrepresentation, you know, of what Prabhupada said, or, you know, something like that. It's good if someone says, Prabhupada says, and if you can give it a reference, that's good. That's the best. You know, or if you quote Prabhupada from the purport, say, Prabhupada says in the Bhagavad Gita, but there's 18,000 verses and purports. You know, but thank God we have Veda base. Because these days, you know, someone says, Prabhupada says, you can literally, you say, where, roughly where, you know. And if you spend half an hour, you can probably look that up. And if you spend a little bit more time, you can probably reference other things on that topic. And if you look into it, you'll get the actual, you know, what Prabhupada really wanted. If we don't do that, we're not even concerned what Prabhupada did. I know when Atul Krishna was here doing the disciples course, and so we did the disciples course, and you know, he asked questions like, you know, have you, you know, experienced things where people appear to be losing contact with Prabhupada, or have you? And I mentioned that, you know, even here in Melbourne, it was a few years back, I overheard two devotees talking. I won't say either way. And one of them was saying, you know, Prabhupada, Prabhupada, it's like Prabhupada's gone. You know, we've got all these new acharyas. Why do they keep talking about Prabhupada? I actually heard in Melbourne, in this courtyard, two devotees talking. I was shocked, you know. So it's the material energy, of course, you know, we may get something close to what, you know, is what is proper. It may be, even on the liberated platform, that's, you know, what they're saying here. This is not just for the karmis, you know, you know, the false ego, you know, the mudhas. The false ego, we're talking about the mudhas, you know, those who don't come to the temple. But Prabhupada's saying, you know, be careful, because even as a devotee, you know, you can become a little bit of a mudha if you're sort of speculating on actually, you know, what ISKCON is, you know, teaching us to do. And, you know, there are, in our society today, we have phenomena where in many parts of the world, like in Russia and, you know, some of the places, they have, you know, expanding Krishna consciousness, getting so many, many devotees. And, of course, you know, we have the benefit of you know, being that the around the world, you know, the Hindu community is, you know, again, there's a resurgence of their, you know, desire for spirituality, and not just so much, you know, a little bit of the hodgepodge of Hinduism, you know, and demigod worship. They really want the essential, the proper teachings. And of course, you know, Prabhupada wanted that as well. You know, Prabhupada wanted that, you know, East and West, you know, that they combine. He always wanted them to cooperate, because he felt the West had, you know, some advantages, and the East has some advantages, and when you put them together, you know, he considers like the blind man, you know, the lame man carrying the blind man, you know. So, you know, they both have the good and bad. So the West was like that. Prabhupada, you know, felt that, you know, sometimes, you know, they have the ability to do a lot of things, you know, materially, and the world tends to follow them in one respect, whereas in India they have an innate sense of spiritual culture, which is one of the things ISKCON has, you know, I've found that ISKCON has become a lot more steady, that the devotees tend to come and stay, because the you know, Hindu community, especially when they take up spiritual life, they have a sort of a that ancient Vedic spiritual culture is second nature to them, as Prabhupada says, just under the skin. And so the movement becomes a lot more steady. So, but, you know, there's a danger that as many, many, many devotees just come in, one thing I've noticed is that in the early days, when someone come in, there's like one new person in the temple. And so everyone helped to train them in a nice way. Now, you can get 100 people, you don't even know that, you know, someone new's come in, and then next thing they've been around for 4 or 5 years, and they're a senior devotee, and you wonder, what was that training? You know, so of course we're introducing Bhakti Shastri and Disciples Course and things like that to make sure that, you know, we're expanding, but do they, you know, do they care about Prabhupada and his teachings of the Disciples Course? Are they studying the Bhagavad Gita, or are we getting some Hinduism? And in other countries, you know, are we getting some of the Russian gypsy culture that's sort of coming in? Or, you know, so there's a lot of dangers, because the movement is growing in some places, that we always have to ensure that Prabhupada's actual teaching, mood and mission, is never lost in the crowd of gurus and speculators and devotees and what have you. You know, Prabhupada's teachings is what will keep this movement strong and pure and free from Maya and on the path back to Godhead. And as soon as we somehow lose sight of that, it is a very, you know, if we're doing something different to what Prabhupada wanted, you can guarantee there'll be ramifications. And we've seen that in ISKCON, where, you know, whole zones of, you know, collapse. We don't want to go into it, but, you know, because they've done something which, you know, Prabhupada didn't even want, and it's caused a lot of trouble. So, you know, the history is there as well. So we shouldn't just be careful not to just, you know, oh, the karmis are all mudhas, you know, thinking they're independent, everything like that. We should look, you know, are we acting independently from Prabhupada? Because if we did, what great fools we are, you know, in the name of being spiritually advanced, you know, what great fools anyone would be to do something different to what Prabhupada would like us to do. You know, where, how can we say that we're under Krishna's shelter? You know, that there'll be something, like Bharat Maharaj. You know, you neglect the real thing for something different. Even he's a bhava bhakti. I mean, you know, if in 100 lifetimes I could become a bhava bhakti, you know, very, very elevated, even on that platform, you can't do it. And that's the teachings. That's Krishna's arranged that teaching for us. So, yeah, because we take this very seriously, we all help each other to... and it's a good practice as a community. If we quote Srila Prabhupada, try and, you know, if you hear something, you think, oh, I might use that one day, write down where it was. Write down like that. And then it's also good to discuss with devotees if you're not sure about it. What else Prabhupada said about this same thing? It was like we're talking about chilies. You know, did he just say one thing about chilies? You know, is that the only thing he ever said? Doubtful. You know, he's been cooking all his life, you know. So, you know, use common sense. Be very sincere to, you know, try and research into Srila Prabhupada, and it makes our position in Krishna consciousness very safe. And then when we help people to become Krishna conscious, it's very potent, because the full blessings of Krishna is there coming through like that. See? Because Bhagavad Gita, you know, there were Bhagavad Gitas all over, you know, India and all over the world. Prabhupada did Bhagavad Gita as it is. You know, he let Krishna speak for himself, as we said. That's the difference. He just let Krishna, we should let Prabhupada speak for himself, not add a little something. And because he let Krishna speak for his, therefore, there was the entire potency that Krishna was present and people become devotees all over the world. If we allow Prabhupada to speak for himself, then Prabhupada is present. And practically, he through us, he is preaching. And that's very, very powerful. People become very, very safe. I'll just leave it there if anyone has any questions or comments on that. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.